Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, August 7th, 2025, and our friend Dmitry Orlov is back with us. Welcome back, Dmitry.
Great to be with you again.
Let us know about your website, Dmitry, and I know that you put a lot of effort to write new articles considering geopolitical issues, economic issues. How can we support you?
Go to boosty.to/cluborlov, C-L-U-B-O-R-L-O-V, and it's, the URL should be on screen right now. Subscribe. I have some free articles, but most of them are for subscribers, mostly for face control. And I publish one or two or three articles every week. There's an article up there right now on Trump's brain, which is a very hot subject right now. We know that he does have a brain, but the question is, how good is it? It's a subject that is worth discussing, and I had some brain specialists contribute some information, which is really quite interesting. So I hope to see you there.
Great. Dmitry, Donald Trump had an ultimatum on Russia in 10 days he was talking about it. And yesterday, it seems that during the meeting between Steve Witkoff and Vladimir Putin, they have agreed to have a meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. Looking at Donald Trump and the way that he's describing the situation in Ukraine on the battlefield, when it comes to the casualties, when it comes to the leverage that the Ukrainian or maybe European together with the United States have over Russia in Ukraine, how do you find it? And how is it going to be somehow important? Because two times or three times they have talked on phone. And every time Donald Trump came out and said everything's amazing and we are progressing. And how about the meeting between the two presidents? Is that going to help for sort out the problems in Ukraine?
No, not at all. Well, first of all, Trump's move to give Russia an ultimatum is a waste of time. Russia doesn't respond to ultimatums. And so that's just a non-starter. Secondly, Trump doesn't know what's going on in the Ukraine because he doesn't really have good intelligence from his own people. And he pays attention to what the Ukrainians say about the situation. And the Ukrainians just lie when they breathe. They suddenly came up with this idea that there are millions of Russian casualties. There aren't. In fact, you know, the casualty rate that the Russian army is suffering is at an all-time low, because the strategy is that well evolved in terms of destroying the Ukrainian military without putting assets at risk. In terms of solving the Ukrainian problem, Trump hasn't really even come close to understanding what the issue is. So he's in no position to even say anything meaningful on the subject. Putin has provided a memorandum explaining what Russia's requirements are. Trump is nowhere near absorbing that information because he doesn't read. He watches Fox News style videos to inform him of what's going on, and he also has conversations with people. In terms of his relationship with Putin, well, Russians typically talk to everyone, friends, enemies, friends of enemies, enemies of friends. That's just the typical Russian style. You know, it's the Russian character. Russians will talk to wild animals, and wild animals will respond pretty well if spoken to in Russian. Bears, wolves, etc. And so it's no surprise that Putin was able to calm Trump's nerves and please him with some polite conversation. in terms of resolving the issues in the Ukraine means absolutely nothing, absolutely nothing. And so we stand now at a point where Trump has made certain threats against Russia. Russia has completely ignored these threats, finding them to be ridiculous. Trump has made threats against Russia's main energy, oil, mostly oil importers, which is China and India. And then China and India told Trump to go pound sand. And the whole thing that Trump tries to do is think that he can do something by imposing sanctions on countries whose imports are irreplaceable at that same price level. So the choice is you buy overpriced items from these countries, overpriced because of tariffs, or you produce overpriced items within the United States, overpriced because the cost of production within the United States is that much more expensive. That is the reason those items are being imported, is that Americans cannot produce them cheaply. And so the entire tariff game is just, you know, his fetish. He has a tariff fetish, but it's not useful. So there's nothing useful going on as far as, you know, people who are Trump watchers, you know, go do something else.
Yeah, Dmitry, I don't see Donald Trump getting prepared for the meeting, because on the part of Russians, they're talking about they're getting prepared, they're preparing everything. It takes time to be prepared. But we know what Russia wants because they have been talking about it. But on the side, on the part of the United States, nobody knows what do they want, what is in the mind of the Trump administration, and what do they want to achieve by this meeting. Do you believe that you mentioned that Donald Trump wasn't provided with the intelligence, with the information that he needs to understand the reality of what's going on in Ukraine? Are they going to provide him with the reality of what's going on in Ukraine before meeting with Vladimir Putin, or he's going to go there just not knowing what's going on there? Because that would be, if they do that, that, as you mentioned, nothing going to come out of the meeting. But if something happens before going to the meeting and they provide him with correct, with reality, what's going on in Ukraine, he may achieve something. Who knows?
Is he going to achieve demilitarization, denazification, human rights for Russian speakers within the Ukraine? Is he going to get rid of all foreign weapons and foreign mercenaries and foreign militaries on Ukrainian soil? Is he going to guarantee Ukraine's neutrality? And beyond Ukraine is just a symptom of a wider disorder. Is he going to provide for Russia's security requirements within the west of Eurasia or not? Because if the answer is not, and I don't think he's even prepared to discuss these issues, they have been steadfastly ignored by all of the West until now, then Russia will basically continue doing what it's doing and achieve the results it requires that way without American participation. And that's all it means. It is not clear to most Russians why America is even there, why it's part of the process, given that its participation so far has been not constructive but destructive, and given that it cannot be trusted to make deals because it's reneged on every single deal it's made, pretty much. So there will be some exchange of pleasantries if Trump shows up in Beijing for the celebration of the end of World War II in China. But beyond the exchange of pleasantries, I don't see what else could be achieved, because the discussion, the conversation hasn't even begun.
We know that he talked with European leaders right after the meeting because he was informing them what has happened during the meeting between Steve Witkoff and Vladimir Putin. He talked with Zelensky as well. And from the signs that I see coming out of Kiev and the Europe, I don't see that much of a change, because every time, as I mentioned before, Donald Trump was talking with Vladimir Putin and said everything's fine, but when he talks with Europeans and Zelensky, it changed everything. And do you feel that, is there, does the United States want to achieve something in Ukraine, or it's something, it's a process of somehow pretending to do something with Russia, but not being really interested in doing it?
Well, look, Trump is stuck between two serious problems. One is that the Ukraine has to be portrayed as not his war, but Biden's war. He wants to blame the whole thing on Biden, even though he was part of the problem that led to the entire conflict. It started with Obama. It continued with Trump. It continued with Biden, and it continues with Trump again. So saying that it's all Biden's fault is empty rhetoric, but that's what Trump is good at. And so he keeps repeating it as many times as it takes. It's proof by repetition. The more he thinks that the more often he repeats it's Biden's war, the more people will believe it. But that's all internal politics. Telling Russians that it's Biden's war makes no difference, because Biden is an American and Trump is an American, and that's the thing that matters. Now, saying that it's Biden's war doesn't really work if it turns out to be Trump's Afghanistan times 10, if it's a defeat. And it's going to be a defeat. So he is trying to keep up appearances for as long as possible, possibly past the midterm election, of something being done about the matter, even though nothing is being done about the matter except shirking the responsibilities for arming the Ukrainians and foisting those responsibilities on the Europeans. That was his great, wonderful, brilliant move. Question is it going to work? It doesn't seem to be working that well. The weapons that were approved for the Ukrainians under Biden are still being delivered, but those are going to run out in a month or two. There are no plans beyond that from anyone, not the Europeans, not the Americans. And that may coincide with the Ukrainian military kind of dissolving because there's a civil war brewing within the Ukraine itself.
Dmitry, you've been to the United States for such a long time. You lived there and you know the society, you know the policy of the United States toward Russia. When it comes to Russia, it seems to me that it doesn't matter if Donald Trump wants to do some sort of change, because the Congress would not help him. You know, the problem is bigger than that, deeper than what we are talking about. It's not just about the Trump administration and the way they're behaving together with Europeans. The Congress is not there. Many people on the part of Republican, Democrats, it somehow is some sort of ideological mindset toward Russia. What's going on in their mind? What is this sort of animosity toward Russia? There is no Soviet Union. There is no Communist Party in Russia, running Russia and Soviet Union, all of, but there's still the animosity is still there. The ideological enmity is still there. What is the main reason of that, that they couldn't solve it so far?
Oh, it's perfectly simple. There's a, it's racism. And the funny thing is that, you know, that sort of attitude towards China or India would be impossible, because that would be white on yellow or white on brown racism, which is not allowed in the United States. Whereas the attitude that the Americans have the Russians is white on white racism, which is allowed. Strangely enough, there is no part of the American mindset that makes white on white racism beyond the pale, not allowed, criminal, horrible, and must not go there. So that's what they do. They demonize the Russians. They demonize Russian leadership. They turn a blind eye towards human rights violations as long as the victims are Russian. And that has been going on pretty much forever, and it'll probably go on forever. And it's embedded within the American mindset. What makes it so very dangerous is that the Americans have a schizophrenic attitude towards Russia. Russia is simultaneously weak and falling apart, and an incredibly strong threat that the Americans must spend trillions of dollars to oppose. And they don't see the contradiction. They fail to see the contradiction between a country that's falling apart, that's collapsing, and a country that is the main military threat that they're facing. They also have a completely misguided attitude towards their own military and its abilities. Everything that the Americans have is obsolete, whereas Russia has all brand new weapons, which are quite far beyond anything that the Americans can imagine, never mind build. And yet they see it fit to threaten Russia, not understanding that if they actually act on any of these threats, then it's suicide for the United States and possibly severe damage for Russia. But Russia at this point is prepared to resist this onslaught, whereas the Americans are defenseless against what the Russians have at this point. But the Americans are not able to understand that because of their mindset and their set of attitudes, ingrained attitudes towards Russia.
Is the European policy an extension of what you've been telling us about the American policy, or is you feel something different happening in Europe?
It's very hard to tell what's happening in Europe. The Europeans are, on a personal level, a lot of the Europeans, the thinking Europeans, not the ones who basically repeat what they hear in the news, have a reasonable attitude towards Russia as a neighboring country that they've traditionally done a lot of business with and have depended on, and which has been dependable as an energy supplier, as a raw material supplier, and certain manufactured products as well, fertilizer. So they don't really have much of an issue with Russia on that level. As far as the politicians that are in power in Russia right now, they are a specific breed that's specifically bred to be anti-Russian by the Americans. And the fact that now Trump is trying to come up with some kind of an accommodation where the United States, which depends on Russia for some things, can have a reasonable relationship with Russia, that is being treated by the European leadership as something that is horribly wrong with Trump. So their first reaction was, let's wait it out. Let's just wait until Trump is out of office and everything will hopefully go back to normal and we can go back to hating Russia like we've been trained to do. Now they're vacillating because they have this idea that they have to go their own way, that the United States will not stand behind them. And now they've hatched this great plan of rearmament, which will allow them to borrow a whole bunch of money. It's their own brilliant plan now. So that's the level of confusion that reigns in Europe. It really has nothing to do with solving any real problem that can be imagined or that exists now.
You've mentioned two mindsets, parallel mindset in the United States. One says that Russia is weak and is falling apart, and the other one says that Russia is dangerous. It's a great threat to America, to their democracy, to their existence. How can that be understood? How can we understand that? And do you feel that these rhetorics comes from different groups of interest in the United States? That's why they're making this, and they don't care about what would be the outcome of this sort of policy, because as long as they're benefiting from this sort of, I would say, strategy on their part to get some sort of benefit, because they want to sell weapons, they want to bring the people, at least in Europe, to say you have a great danger in your region, you have to be more dependent on us, on the United States. And on, because without having these two different, as you've mentioned, these contradictions, you cannot make policies, you cannot sell weapons. We have the same in Japan. You have to have something like North Korea to sell weapons to South Korea, to Japan. And in the Middle East, you have to have Iran to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia and other countries. You know, they're making these sort of enemies, regional enemies for the countries that were for the neighboring countries. And there's because they have some sort of policy of sending weapons, selling weapons, and all of that. But I don't see that would be beneficial in a long run for the United States. And do you feel it's the same? Is that the main reason?
I think it goes back a lot further. It goes back to the end of World War II, where the United States thought that Russia was down for the count, and then Russia launched Sputnik and built nuclear power plant and had lots and lots of great victories and rebuilt suddenly and rebuilt Eastern Europe, and the United States had to compete. The United States, after World War II, had just come out of the Great Depression and was in a position to compete. So both the Soviet Union and the United States pursued a socialist model of development, although the United States claimed that it was a capitalist model, but they introduced things like social security, etc. So both were socialist, and both produced a middle class and prosperity because they were competing on that level. And then the Soviet Union fell apart, and Americans breathed a sigh of relief because they no longer had to feed all these people. They once again could just go back to exploiting people in whatever way they wanted, because the socialist model, they said, failed. And now that Russia has rebuilt itself, and on top of that, China has grown very nicely. The size of the Chinese economy grew by a factor of 10 so far this century. And other communist socialist countries like Vietnam are doing really well. So that is something that the Americans don't know how to react to anymore, because they're no longer in a position to embrace the socialist model and get to continue to take care of people to that level. So if you look at the entire West, It's in a profound state of decay. The infrastructure is really bad. There are bed bugs all over Paris, and rats running around, and Manchester, second largest city in the UK, is just strewn with garbage half the time, and crime rates are going through the roof, and it just, the only solution that the West has now is pretend that Russia somehow doesn't exist or is terrible, because it's enough for Tucker Carlson to go into a Russian supermarket in Moscow for Americans' heads to explode at this point. So that sort of information has to be just completely kept out of public view, because there is no other solution, because the West can no longer compete. So if it cannot compete socially, how else can it compete? Well, it can pretend to compete militarily by pretending that Russia is a huge military threat. You know, it's another circle of denial, I would say. And it's a ploy that isn't going to work very well, because Russia is not just socially and economically stronger, it's also militarily stronger, as is China at this point, whereas the combined West is sort of drifting apart. I mean, if you look at, say, the German economy, that peaked in 2007. Industrial production in Germany peaked in Germany it was a little later. In Italy, it peaked in 2007. In Italy, for instance, which is a big European economy, that's down by almost a quarter since the beginning of the century. And that's the pattern. So some countries are growing. Russia is one of them. China is one of them. And some countries are shrinking. United States is growing a little bit, but taking on lots of debt. And Europe as a whole is shrinking.
The fight, Dmitry, whenever Donald Trump is talking about domestic policies in the United States, is attacking the left attacking the right, far right. But when it comes to the economy, you've mentioned the socialist policies and somehow social security and all of these programs that would work for majority of people in the country. How is that gonna, do you think, as we see, I think in Russia we have the same thing as in China. You see some sort of combination between capitalism and socialism, you know? You see the education, health, and all of these areas that are so much important, they're preparing them, they're offering them to the vast majority of people in the country. And on the other hand, you see some sort of competition between different sectors of the economy, and the private economy, the economy that is related to the federal government, to the government, all of this complexity. But in the United States, still ideological. When you talk about socialism, it seems like you are going far left. And if the left, when it wants to attack the capitalism, they go to, and they sort of fascists and all of these arguments. Don't you think that there is still no understanding within the leadership in the United States that there is a common ground between the two, and they can cooperate with each other, as we see, I would argue, in Russia, since I've learned it from Russia, and China as well. China is a good example of that. Is that coming to the mind of, is it possible for the society like the one in the United States to understand that?
Well, the problem with the United States is that it's not a country, it's a bunch of countries. States are countries. And then there's this hypertrophied center. The problem with it is that it's bankrupt. So, for instance, Social Security is the biggest federal program there is. It's going to be bankrupt in 7 or 8 years, according to the Social Security Administration. There are not enough people paying into it relative to the number of people being paid by it. There are now only 2 and some workers per retiree. And that is not a sustainable pattern. So there'll be major cuts to Social Security. At the same time, there's more and more people as private retirement schemes are starting to fail, or they've been failing for a while now, where Social Security is the only income a lot of people have. And so there'll be a lot of older poor people, and older people tend to vote more than younger people. So that will cause major dislocation, political dislocation within the United States. That is going to happen within the next 2 or 3 election cycles. So we need to look forward to massive political instability within the United States as the socialist trappings that were introduced after World War II in an effort to compete with the Soviet Union more or less evaporate.
And the problem is far worse, in my opinion, because they're trying to destroy what Europe has and what Europe had in terms of the social security programs. Do you think by militarization of Europe, it seems that Europe is heading towards some sort of militarization. They want to build up their military and sacrificing their social programs. Is Europe heading toward the same situation that we're witnessing in the United States?
I think the Europeans are, the European leadership is treating militarization as a wonderful way to build a new money laundry, because the Ukrainian money laundry is failing. And their new plan is borrow a whole bunch of money, pretend to be using it to build weapons, which Europe is in no position to do, because every single weapon system has to have lots of American components. That's how NATO has been structured since World War II. The Americans made sure that the Europeans were not capable of providing for their own security without American help. So the whole thing is doomed. But as they try to do this, or pretend to do this, there'll be a lot of money that they'll be able to pocket. The entire military industrial complex in Europe is peopled with nephews and cousins and brothers of people in power. And so it's one big happy family, and they'll borrow a bunch of money and they'll pocket most of it. And then when the whole thing starts to collapse, they'll flee to some tropical paradise and live out their days there. That's their dream. They didn't get rich enough off of the Ukraine. So now they want to continue this bonanza by saddling their countries with even higher levels of government debt.
We know that Donald Trump is trying to put secondary tariffs on India. On the other hand, we've learned that Russia and India are deepening their relationship, and they're talking about deepening their economic ties. How is that going to work for India? Do you think that in the mind of the United States, is it possible to somehow put a lot of pressure on Indians and make and change their mind toward Russia?
Well, look, the United States is a relatively small economy. If you ignore internal services, which India is not concerned with at all, it's not that big, and it doesn't make that much stuff that India absolutely requires. On the other hand, Russia produces lots of stuff that India needs and wants. Oil is one of them. So India is in no position to stop buying Russian oil. Same thing with China. Russia is a major food producer, and India has a huge population, and which is sometimes difficult to feed. While Russia is the biggest grain exporter in the world, Russia also makes weapon systems with no strings attached, unlike the Americans. India is interested in buying weapon systems from Russia. Lots of other things that Russia produces that are and consumes in India's pharmaceutical industry replaced American pharmaceuticals on the Russian market. So Russia no longer imports pharmaceuticals from the United States. It imports them from India. And so all of these things mean that India needs Russia. India doesn't really need the United States and shouldn't need the United States given how the United States behaves. So Russia is not trying to put pressure on India. Russia is making useful offers to India that India is free to agree to or to decline based on their own national interests, its own old confluence of interests. Whereas the United States is under Trump is on this quixotic mission to somehow shore up the American economy at everyone else's expense. Trump is treating the trade imbalance with the rest of the world, which is huge, which the United States have, as somebody else's fault. Whereas the fact is that the United States imports all of these products and imports much more than it exports because the rest of the world is that much more productive than the United States. Is it possible to make the United States more productive? Well, yes, if you hop into a time machine, go back 20 years and completely revise the economy and the educational system, then yes. But barring that, then no, that train has left the station a long time ago. So all of these sanctions are strictly taxes on Americans because either they will have to pay more for foreign products or they will have to pay more for domestic products because Americans can't make those same products as cheaply as the rest of the world.
Yeah. Do you feel that Donald Trump can somehow change the situation in the 3 years to come and in a short term? If he tries to do that, what would be the solution in your opinion? What would be the best solution for the United States to go after some sort of, I don't know, to make some sort of programs to these jobs coming back to the United States and making them affordable?
Oh, well, that's a waste of time. That's a complete waste of time. The first thing that the United States should do is get rid of Trump because he's senile and becoming very dangerous. He had a flame war on the internet with Dmitry Medvedev, who is a very serious person, but also has some people on his staff that like to basically cause havoc on social media and provoke people. They're basically internet trolls. He has some internet trolls working for him. And so they trolled Trump, and Trump responded by threatening to deploy nuclear attack submarines close to Russia. That shows that, first of all, Trump is psychologically unbalanced. His response to being trolled on the internet is to threaten nuclear attack. Somebody like that shouldn't be in the White House. Somebody like that should be in a hospital, in a special ward with padded cells. And so that's the first thing to get through to everyone, is Trump is a danger to himself and everyone else and should be nowhere near anything executive. Get rid of him somehow. Compile a dossier, you know, get some medical experts together, have them provide a diagnosis. Based on that diagnosis, there's a bit in the U.S. Constitution that allows you to get rid of a sitting president who is no longer able to do his job. So get rid of Trump. And that's the first step. But if that's not done, then what is going to be happening to the United States is probably bad, but more interestingly, random, because Trump is now a random word salad and number generator. He just spews different stuff on different days. He doesn't remember what the last thing he said. He contradicts himself constantly, and One of the symptoms of his disease is what's called confabulation, where somebody is absolutely convinced of something that has happened, whereas that did not happen at all. And he's on the record confabulating in front of cameras, which is medical evidence. Medical evidence. So that is the challenge facing the United States. And I think that, not I think, but medical specialists have told me who have been watching Trump for a while now, is that his disease is developing rather quickly. So this time next year, I think it would be pretty much obvious to everyone that Trump is a gibbering idiot. And the task will be how to get rid of him.
Yeah. Yesterday he was asked if he knows about that Zelensky is using the people with 60 years, people of the age of 60 years old and even older than that. He said he has no information on that. He didn't know that. And we were talking about it for, 8 months, about the way that Ukrainians are somehow sending young people and old people to the battlefield. And the president of the United States, who's providing Ukraine with everything, with money, with weapons, doesn't know what's going on in Ukraine. Dmitry, is there any sort of sign? Because many people still believe that Donald Trump can do something in Ukraine. But do we have any sort of sign that he's going to be able to do it, or he's willing to do it? Who are the donors?
Well, like I said, is he going to?
Because when it comes to the case of Ukraine, we have to understand who's behind the project Ukraine, and are those people powerful enough to influence the Trump administration? It seems that so far they were so much successful in achieving that. And to what extent they're going to do it? And are there any sort of limits to their power?
Well, Russia has a strategy with regard to the Ukraine, which is basically grind up the Ukrainian military and all of the weapons being it is being provided with on the battlefield, gaining territory as the opportunity presents itself, but not as the main goal. And that strategy is quite successful. War on the battlefield is evolving, and Russia is making good use of that opportunity to train people and develop new weapon systems. There are major advances in drone warfare that Russia has achieved. And so that is very useful for Russia, and Russia will keep doing this until the Ukraine fails and its Western supporters give up. Now, what does this have to do with Trump? What does this have to do with people who influence Trump? From what I can see so far, absolutely nothing. If they wanted to have a role to play, a positive role to play, saving the lives of the Ukrainians, they would basically pay attention to Russian demands and figure out that meeting these demands is the way to stop the bloodshed. And they're certainly in a position to force the Ukrainians to capitulate and accede to Russia's demands. They could theoretically do that. Are they going to do that? No, they're not, because their strategy is to postpone the inevitable. What they're afraid of is another Afghanistan, this time pinned on Trump and the Republican Party. And so they, on the other hand, they can't keep paying for this. So they're trying to get the Europeans to pay for it. and that's not working very well. So it's unclear how they will succeed in perpetuating this conflict on the Ukrainian side. They may not succeed in perpetuating it past the midterm election next year, which will be a disaster for the Republican Party. Another Afghanistan times 10. So in terms of what they can do to bring it to a successful conclusion, peaceful conclusion, life-saving conclusion, I think nothing. I think that they are not capable.